Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio for Sunday the 4th of July. This week we start with a special report into alleged child abuse. In Jersey, the senator who blew the whistle on child abuse at the Hauts de la Garenne Children's Home, as you may remember in the news a while ago, Stuart Siverett, is now facing jail himself. We hear from another abuse victim's legal advisor, Robert Green, who's also found himself under arrest. We have some music from Zimbabwe and chat to a guy named Chanda. We hear from Anthea Page, who's been interviewing some of Britain's young film talent who she met over in Eastern Europe. One of Britain's greatest living film directors, Ken Loach, was here in Bristol last week, and he talked in withering terms about the BBC's coverage of the Gaza Aid flotilla story. David Cole from the Avon Valley Railway is also here to tell us about their new restaurant on the move, which has its first outing later this month. And we also hear from Charles Thompson, who eagle-eared listeners will recognise from a long time ago as being a football commentator we've had on before. He gives us an obituary of our World Cup team's efforts. And we also have Jeff Sparks here later on to give us a What's On guide in and around Bristol. The violent or sexual abuse of children is far more widespread, particularly in the social services care system, than most people realise. That is an allegation of Robert Green, who is a legal advisor to alleged Down syndrome sex abuse victim Holly Grieg. A BBC Scotland documentary was recorded last summer with Holly and other victims, but cancelled at the last minute. In this special report, Dialect's Tony Gosling speaks to Robert Green about the case and asks him about the circumstances that led to his arrest while campaigning to be elected as MP for Aberdeen earlier this year. Allegations of abuse present a serious challenge for organisations which represent children, in this case the Down Syndrome Association. Other organisations such as Scotland Against Crooked Lawyers, though, have been able to help.
I'm Robert Green. I'm the legal representative for Holly and Anne Gregg. There isn't really a quick way of bringing this story together because it's an extremely complicated one as well as a horrifying one, really on two levels. One is the case itself, which is to do with a horrifying series of systematic rapes on Holly Gregg, who has Down syndrome, and other children as well. It's been going on for many, many years. And also the attempts by the Scottish establishment to cover the story up. One of the difficulties that we've had is that the members of the rape gang, which I'll refer to it in that way, are all professionals, including a sheriff, which is the Scottish equivalent to a judge, and also a senior police officer, solicitors, care workers, a headmaster, an accountant, fire officers, and lots of people in the professions there involved in the ring. The main people in the ring have all been involved in the abuse of children.
Can you tell us how you came to be arrested after being Anne and Holly's legal representative?
Yes, I decided that I would go up to Scotland on the 12th of February, and the prime reason for that was that I intended to stand in the Aberdeen South constituency in the general election on just one issue, to actually promote the Holly Gregg case. And that was my intention. I'd never been to Aberdeen before, and I wanted to introduce myself to the constituents there. So I publicly announced that I was going to be just off Union Street, which is the main street in Aberdeen, at 10:30 on the morning of Friday, the 12th of February, and invited all kinds of people to come, the media, members of the public, anyone who actually wanted to see me, and I was going to hand out leaflets and talk to people as they thought fit. And that was my objective for going there. And what happened, in fact, was that at about 10 o'clock, two CID officers on just off a side street, off Union Street, suddenly approached me and asked me to identify myself, and then told me they had a warrant for my arrest. I asked them on what grounds, and they said breach of the peace. And of course, I thought that was rather odd, just to be peacefully walking along the street in Aberdeen and being picked up for breach of the peace. So that was an interesting start to my day on the 12th of February. Well, then I was taken to the main police station in Aberdeen, Queen Street Police Station. I was interviewed by the two officers involved. That was DS Drummond and DC Crowder. And then I had all my things taken away from me. I was put in a cell, and I remained in that cell until the Monday. So it was a Friday the 12th. I was in until the 15th of February. And I was told later on Friday that I was to be charged with a breach of police at Stonehaven Sheriff Court on Monday the 15th of February, which of course happened.
And so what happened at that hearing?
At the hearing, there was very little happened, actually. A duty solicitor came to Stonehaven to see me when I was being held in the temporary cell there. And the hearing was held in camera, which rather puzzled me. But it was after the hearing that the solicitor suddenly said to me, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Green says there are lots of people from the press outside, and I would advise you to say as little as possible to them about the case." Obviously, I had to agree to some rather draconian bail conditions, because the Crown Office, who do the prosecutions in Scotland, did not want me released. They wanted me to remain in custody. So I did sign, under duress, I did sign sort of bail conditions, and then they let me out.
So what were those bail conditions?
Well, there are quite a number of them, but the most important things were that all the people in the ring were named on the public document, but I'm not allowed to mention them, and I can't do anything that might upset them. There were several other issues. I've got to report 3 times a week at my local police station in Warrington in Cheshire, but one of the interesting points on the conditions, which I think could be interpreted in many ways, is that I am not supposed to do anything that will prevent the course of justice taking place. Now, I have never done anything ever to prevent the course of justice taking place, and I think that particular question or that particular order might be very well placed before the people who've been trying to silence me.
One of the extraordinary aspects to this case is that Holly's mum, Anne, has been paid a considerable sum in compensation for the crime against her daughter. But despite the evidence, her alleged abusers have not faced trial. So the big question is, how widespread is child abuse, and why do some abusers appear to be above the law?
Down syndrome children, or even adults for that matter, are really quite open to sexual abuse particularly, or other kinds of abuse of course, but sexual abuse perhaps is the particular one we're looking at in this particular instance, because of course people who abuse them will probably assume that they are not competent witnesses and will never be able to testify against them. When I first came into the case, obviously I realised we had a tough job because of I knew the authorities in Scotland were doing everything to cover the case up, and we had evidence of that right from the start. But I spoke to 2 people, prominent people in the Down Syndrome Association in England, based at the head office in Teddington in Middlesex, Susanna Seaman and the press officer John Smithies. Now, these 2 people have been very helpful to Anne and Holly in the past, and when I came in to try and break the story, they were enormously helpful on the basis that they are very well aware, and they told us they were very well aware, of people with Down syndrome and indeed other learning difficulties being sexually abused in many parts of the country, and that they knew that the authorities were trying to cover them up in many places.
So what were they able to do for you as part of the Down Syndrome Association?
Well, at the time, they weren't actually doing anything practical about it, apart from giving 100% support for everything that I was trying to do, even my more unorthodox methods, like naming the people in the ring and their victims. They knew all about that and approved of everything that I did. I'd been dealing with the case for about 7 months at that time, and I'd done a lot of publicity on it. I'd publicised the names not only in a public speech on the 3rd of October in Edinburgh, but I'd also put the names on the internet earlier, so I would make it very clear that I was out to expose the people involved. But at the end of October, I got a call from John Smithies one Thursday, and John sounded very perturbed. He said, "Well, I'm very concerned." He said, "I've been called to a meeting over the Holly Gregg case from my chief executive officer, Carol Boyes, who I should just add happens to be a lawyer. And she's concerned. She wants to talk to me." And I said, "Well, why is it that she's so concerned?" And he said, "Well, I don't know till I've seen her, but," he says, I have been just pushing things around within the organisation on the documents that are in the public domain about Holly's case, things that you in particular and the press as well have actually put out on this. But can you tell me, have you received any legal threats whatsoever or any threats of any kind?" So I said, "Well, no, John, I haven't, even after naming everyone on the 3rd of October, which predated this by about 3 weeks, not one person has actually approached me in any way whatsoever. I haven't no threats whatsoever. And he said, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. And I said, well, yes, I don't really see that you possibly have done anything wrong, but I hope everything goes well for you. Anyway, that was the end of the conversation. I spoke to John next on Thursday, and he told me then that Carol Boyes, the chief executive, had sacked him. So I said, John, well, that's terrible. I'm very sorry to hear that. Why would that be? And he said that Carol Boyes had decided that she thought that my actions in talking about the Holly Gregg case in the way that I had done would possibly or could possibly jeopardise the Down Syndrome Association in that legal action may be taken against us.
But don't you think it jeopardises the integrity of the Down Syndrome Association if they're not protecting Down Syndrome children from abuse?
That is the whole point, that I do believe that the chief executive, in sacking a good and honest man who is doing his duty to the Down Syndrome Association, has in fact betrayed the interests of the very people that she is supposed to be and is being paid for to support and protect. I came into the case because of Scotland Against Crooked Lawyers after I made a speech at their annual general meeting about another totally different case I was investigating in England. And as a result of that, I was asked by the chairman and founder of the group, a very loyal and patriotic Scotsman called Stuart Usher, if there's anything at all I could do for these two poor ladies who were in Shropshire. They'd had to flee their own home country of Scotland to get away from the gang and all the threats. And Stuart told me this is really about the most terrible story you'd ever heard of. And if there was anything at all that I could bring it into the public domain in order to protect the victims and to get justice for Holly and the others, was there anything at all that I could do? So I was very busy with my other case and didn't really want to take it on at the time because I hadn't got much time. But as it happens, once I'd spoken to Anne, I was very, very impressed with her as a person. I was impressed with her integrity and her courage, and I really believed that what she was telling me was the truth. And obviously, she had a lot of documentation to back that up, and subsequently, I decided I would do the very best I could to try and help them. Scotland Against Crooked Lawyers have been, I should just add, have been extremely supportive throughout, as they are at this present time. Stuart and the other members have been really making tremendous inroads in bringing the case to the public's domain. Stuart Usher has frequently spoken on many radio stations, both in the UK and abroad, and they have been organising demonstrations in Scotland. There have been 4 demonstrations already, predominantly pursuing the case of Holly Gregg. Since taking on the Holly case, and since the huge amount of publicity worldwide that's come about really as a result of me being arrested, I have had many, many people from all over the country, a lot from Scotland, but not just Scotland, telling me about the horrific cases they've had over this situation. Many people have been abused. I can't obviously verify for this because they're not my cases and I haven't investigated it fully, but I would say that even if only 70 or 75% of the people who've told me about the cases and their suffering are telling the truth, that presents a really major problem in this country. And it does make you wonder, because of the cover-up by authorities all over Britain, who in fact is governing Britain.
Why is it, do you think, that these cases aren't properly investigated by the police and the press?
It does seem to be pressure from the top. I do find that the people I'm dealing with at the lower levels, whether it's in the police or some of the other public organisations, tend to be appalled, as just about everyone is, by paedophilia. They hate it and they want to do the best to try and to stop it. But it does seem at every turn it is people at the top who seem to be holding things down and trying to keep the lid on it. The reason is hard to imagine. I guess blackmail comes into it. I think that springs into mind, but one can't be quite sure. But obviously, one should always say, what kind of people would want to prevent these cases being exposed?
Robert Green there, ending that report on allegations of child abuse in Aberdeen by Tony Gosling. You can follow the latest on the Holly Gregg case on the web at stolenkids-holly.blogspot.com. Holly is spelt with an IE and not a Y, and Grieg is spelt GRIEG. And you can contact Robert Green via that website. Our roving reporter, Anthea Page, is gallivanting around Eastern Europe, but she found time to do an interview with an animator called Tom Hicks, who's from London.
I'm sitting by the sea, and I've just bumped into an animator.
Hi, my name is Tom Hicks.
Can you tell us about your company?
Well, I work in a studio in Stoke Newington with me and three friends, and we have like a collective where we all work on animation and illustration projects, either individually or together. I make like pop promos, like music videos. So I build like animated films to sync with songs, and I pitch ideas to bands and to record labels, and then I make those films that I pitched.
Have you made any for Bristol bands?
Yeah, I made some videos for a band called Gravenhurst on Warp Records, and they're like nice, really enjoyable projects because the music is so great and creatively very nice and very open for interesting ideas.
So what sort of animation did you do for that band?
Well, I'm quite a traditional animator, like drawing and some compositing, but just trying to build a film that is the same spirit as the music. So somehow trying to create something that where you feel that the music and the animation are inseparable. You can't separate them. They kind of belong together because they start as two very separate things. And the job is to try and make something feel like it belongs with that music. So the universe you create in the film actually feels the same as the music.
How long does it take you to do, say, 1 minute of animation?
Well, for a promo, I'd normally have like about, for like I say, a 4 or 5 minute music video, I'd probably have like normally a month of time. But it doesn't really work like that. It's not really like this set much time. It's more like I have 6 weeks to make something, and I work it out within that time so I can complete the film within that time schedule. Yeah.
So tell us about your films here at the festival.
I've got two music videos here. One's called Chalk Stars, and one's called I'd Rather Be With You. And they're two commissioned music videos. And they're both quite different. The Chalk Stars is very dark and very heavy animation, black and white. And the I'd Rather Be With You is a lot more colourful, for a guy called Joshua Whedon. So it's kind of quite a softer, more romantic kind of piece of work, I think.
Do you work on your own?
I work on my own, or I work with my friends in my studio. Often, like for illustration work, I'll almost always work on my own. But for animation, generally, because the projects are a bit bigger, at least at some point I'll work with somebody else who's going to help me with the animation or going to collaborate with.
So have you submitted any to Encounters in Bristol?
No, I haven't yet. I have been to Encounters a few times, but I've been to quite a few festivals this year, and I will send my work out to more places when I have time. But I'm taking a bit of time out to go to some different festivals with my films over the last month and for the next month in the future. And I always come back feeling kind of refreshed and excited to keep making new films. So always good to go to festivals.
So what's your website?
I'm just building one at the moment, but I've got a Vimeo account. So if you look on Vimeo and look for Thomas Hicks, my work is there.
Well, good luck in the festival.
Thank you very much. It's very kind. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to Tom Hicks for his time, and we wish Anthea the best of luck as she gallivants around the globe. Okay, long-term eagle-eared listeners might remember a fellow named Charles Thompson, who does a very good bit of football commentary. He has returned out of the blue. There's been a bit of doom and gloom in the world of football, as you might have noticed. Fabio Capelli, as this goes out, may or may not still be in his job. Who knows? But he's here right now. Hello.
Hi there. Hi. Yeah, out of the blues I have arrived.
Okay.
Yeah, joke. Yeah. Problems. Could anyone see this happening? I was aware that it might happen, so I didn't actually watch the game England-Germany. I went and sat in a meadow and read some poetry because I just felt it was going to be terrible. And it was terrible. I have seen the highlights, however. I think the problems are, firstly, the coaching system in Britain. We're not actually teaching people to play as a team. If you look at Holland, if you look at Brazil, you don't have any sense of big egos. It's all the team knitting together, team playing together. That's just part of their whole sensibility. We you could say Brazil have got it in their blood, but Holland? Yeah, so we need to follow what Holland are doing, I think, and that's a long-term strategy. And then, of course, the other problem is the number of English players in the Premier League. We've only got 38.6, or some appalling percentage. Mm-hmm. And obviously, some of them are playing in the lower teams. Upson, Green, poor old Green. James played for a relegated team. So we haven't got players in the top four or five, enough players in top four or five. And even if they are, they're not playing very well. Liverpool aren't playing very well. Gerrard isn't playing very well. So I think we have to change our coaching system right across Britain. So it's all pass and go and all thinking as a team. Okay, and that means every team that's any good has to have that sort of system. and concentrate much more on the skills than on winning at lower levels. You know, it's just the skills. You're only going to win a World Cup with a beautiful team. You're not going to win with a few good players who don't knit together. And then we've got to reduce the number of players in the Premier League who are foreign and just get this sort of monster of capitalism under control. In Germany, they cap the amount of money any player can earn. They push the young lads into the Bundesliga. The young lads have experience. Mm. They learn and they're ready. And also they're playing as a team. We've got some excellent young lads, Jack Wilshere, and some under 17 lads. Will they get their chance in a Premier outfit regularly? If they don't, they're not going to be ready to play in a tournament.
Do you think people going to play in the World Cup should really get $100,000 a week?
No. It's ridiculous, it's absurd, and any country that has huge differentials in pay is not going to be a very happy country. We don't want this huge differential in pay. It's absolutely ridiculous to have £100,000 a week. Mm. £10,000 would be enough. And Jimmy Greaves used to catch the bus to Spurs to play for Spurs. I mean, and he was hungry. He was hungry to win. If you have too much money, you lose that appetite, that desire. The Germans cap their salaries. You can see they're hungry to win, and we're not. So, but of course, capitalism is capitalism. You can't change it. Don't like to be too political here. But
Fabio, should he go or should he stay?
He's very strict. He's a bit inflexible. Our greatest managers have been flexible, I think. Like Venables was flexible. He's not flexible, but who would replace him? I would always give a guy another shot, but he is costing a great deal of money. Venables, Bobby Rodson, they could change the tactics according to the game, according to the situation. Robson did in 1990 and came up with a good result. Venables was very, very flexible with his tactics and came up with a pretty good result, only went out on penalties in the semi-final. If you are inflexible, as Capello was, and didn't play Rooney up on his own as a striker, inflexible and stubborn, you can't win tournaments. You have to realise that something needs to be changed and change it, and he can't do that. So, but who could replace him? And I'd always give him another shot. But they probably don't understand him. You know. But he is a great manager. But you want someone who's absolutely brilliant, a kind of Clough guy, Venables guy. But where are they? Where are they? You tell me a great. And English, you can communicate. Yeah. Maybe Harry Redknapp, about the only one I can think of. Because the managers have gone. We don't have English managers anymore. Yeah. Hmm. So, I mean, this huge Premier League monster has just completely shot our chances. And we never did very well. We've never done very well in the past, but we're doing worse now.
Okay, well, Charles Thompson, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Back when John Major was Prime Minister, my goodness, that seems like a long time ago, we were all told that privatisation would deliver cheaper and more efficient rail travel. Well, a few months ago, Britain's first £1,000 return fare was announced, and trains are so expensive that unless you book well ahead, only people on expense accounts can afford to use them. As if that wasn't bad enough, it was announced this week that rail fares will be going up another 10%, and that's another rise of about 500% above inflation. But all is not lost. Down at Bitton Station near Cadbury Heath, a new rail service is about to be inaugurated. It's the Avon Valley Railway's Fish and Chip Restaurant. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to Avon Valley's chunky controller, David Cole.
My name's David Cole and I'm the development manager for the Avon Valley Railway. And my role really is to coordinate all the activities that go on and ensure that both our volunteers and our visitors come and have a wonderful time and go away happy. The railway's run pretty much entirely by volunteers, so there's really a wide range of opportunities for people to get involved and enjoy themselves and provide a wonderful service for the public. We're certainly able to train people up, that's not a problem at all. We find that people have different thoughts about volunteering. Some of them are quite happy just to come along and stand on the platform and meet and greet people, whilst others want to become engine drivers, which takes several years of training and understanding about how steam engines work. So we're quite happy to talk to anybody if they're interested in volunteering, have a word with them, see what they want to do, see if it fits in with our opportunities, and then if necessary train them up.
Now, what sort of facilities do you have? We've got a sort of very old-fashioned looking engine shed in with an old steam engine inside here. And what kind of work is going on?
The railway itself, obviously, is heritage, and our heritage starts in 1869 when both this goodshed and the station were built. Our engines range from sort of early 1930s up to the 50s and 60s. Railway carriages, similar sort of age. So there's a lot of things that can be done, and we find that the volunteers that have already come to us either have some of the skills already, or we can teach them the skills that are needed. As I say, with the steam engines, it takes a little bit longer than perhaps learning how to use a screwdriver and a drill.
What events have you got coming up in the next few weeks?
Well, over the next month, we've got a variety of events that are coming up. On the evening of the 14th of July, we're running for the first time an evening fish and chip train. So if you want to come along and have a nice trip on the train and also enjoy some fish and chips, then that's the evening for you. But you do need to book in advance. And then on the 18th of July, we have our popular teddy bears picnic. Now, with the teddy bears picnic, any children that come along bring their teddy bears with them. They can travel free of charge on the train. I'm afraid that doesn't apply to the adults. If they bring their teddy bears, I'm afraid they still have to pay. And then we have various activities on the day for the children. We have a magic show, face painting, various things going on in addition to the train rides. And then on the 15th of August, we have our popular vintage bus rally, which normally attracts about 100 buses ranging from the 1930s up to the modern day, and people can travel free on those into Bristol, into Bath, across to the railway, because the event actually is held and based at the Park and Ride at Brislington.
So what about for you personally? What is it that attracts you to working at a place like this?
Well, it's certainly different. I spent 18 years working for NatWest, and NatWest, I had no problems working for you at all. But sat in an office all the time was not exactly something I really wanted to do. Yes, I'm sat in an office here for a reasonable amount of time, but the environment is much better with all the volunteers, a wonderful rapport with them all, and it's just such a wonderful place to work.
And what projects have you got at the railway going on at the moment? Because there's quite a lot of sort of semi-fixed up. You've got carriages and steam engines and things like that here. You know, what are your favourite projects that you've got on the go at the moment?
Well, I think at the moment the main thing for me is the work that we're doing on some of our railway carriages. We have two which are in the process of being completed. One is going to be one of our new dining cars for our Sunday lunch trains. The other one is an additional carriage for use in conjunction with our buffet, which we're looking to offer to groups such as Probus and Rotary Clubs that can come along and have meetings, and we can provide meals for them. And that's all about providing something special, something extra for our visitors. Of course, as you say, there's plenty of work that needs to be done on the steam engines and the diesel locomotives as well as the infrastructure, making sure that our 3 miles of track is kept clean, that the weeds are kept down. There is so much to do, and certainly volunteers would be very welcome in any of those areas at all.
Well, thank you to David Cole for his time there. He's the manager of Avon Valley Railway, talking to our very own Tony Gosling. And in case you missed those dates, Bristol's first ever fish and chip supper train, call us a tongue twister, departs on Wednesday evening, 14th of July. The Teddy Bears Picnic Train, where children with teddies travel free, lets off steam on Sunday the 18th of July. And the Vintage Bus Rally, with free vintage bus trips from Bitton and Brislington Park and Ride, rides off up the road on Sunday the 15th of August.
Hippa! said Kukuni was a hero of Africa. Bambaataa was a hero of Africa. Moshoeshoe, hero of Africa, down there in Lesotho. Nehanda was a hero of Africa in Zimbabwe. Eduardo Mondlane, hero of Africa, Mozambique. Lumumba was a hero of Africa by the CIA. A hero of Africa, down there in South Africa. Nehanda, yeah, yeah,
hero of Africa.
Bambaataa, Sekukuni,
hero of Africa.
Oppression.
Hero of Africa. Hero.
There you are.
Just heard Heroes of Africa there by Chimani Mani, and I'd like to introduce to the studio Chando. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about Chimani Mani. How many of you are there?
Yeah, it's a five-piece band.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's all guys. We used to have a female vocalist, but she has left, so it's a five-piece now.
Okay, yeah. And you are from Zimbabwe. Are you all from Zimbabwe?
Yeah, we're all from Zimbabwe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you're here because you're an asylum seeker at the moment. How long have you been here?
Since 2007, June 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does the application sort of procedure work? How long were you here before you, you know, when before you apply to become an asylum seeker? How long does it take, is it?
Yeah, it started with a working visa. So, 2008, towards the end, I decided to seek. So it's a bit complicated at the moment, but we're getting there. I think by October this year, we may get the results.
Right, so it's taken sort of 2 years to get this far down the process.
Yeah, it's a long process, you know. I think Home Office, they've got a backlog, so right. I'm in the queue.
Okay. Is it, when you sort of decided to become an asylum seeker, what was that, quite an intimidating sort of process?
It is, definitely, because you think, on the other hand, you want to go home, and, you know, they know that you have seeked asylum, and so it's really complicated, but I don't have a choice, because I want to be here, it's safe, and if I manage to get the grant, if they grant me, then I can be flexible doing my work without any fear, and you know, improving my music. But at the moment, I'm limited what I do.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, do you have, what sort of rights do you have as an asylum seeker? Can you get a job? Do you get any benefits?
No, I don't. So, but I can do the music, but it's all limited. There's some places they need to ask some sort of, you know, so it's all limited.
So how do you get by?
Well, as an African, I'm not offending anyone, but as an African, I grew up the tough way. So we are used to tough ways, hard life. But yeah, we're surviving, got friends around you, you know, they can help you here and there. So, yeah, I'm surviving.
Yeah. Just back to the music. Tell me a little bit about the song that we just heard. So who are the heroes of Africa in context of...
Yeah, we decided to compose a song, Heroes of Africa, because they are, you know, hidden. The history doesn't talk about these people. Like, for example, in Zimbabwe, we used to have Nehanda and Kagui. Probably you don't know them.
No.
These people, they first resisted the colonizers when they first came. So they were heroes, but nobody knows them. Of course, everybody knows Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. And the others are like in Angola, Queen Jinga. You know, she was a queen in Angola, but nobody knows. So we're trying to say, oh, there's heroes of Africa, apart from all the troubles, the corruption, but there are some good people who did good things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was the song all about.
Where did you live in Zimbabwe? Was it sort of a city or urban area?
Yeah, Harare, the capital city.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was it like? What made you sort of live in fear? That's a very broad question in the context of an awful lot of...
Because the young people in Zimbabwe today, they didn't fight the war during the Rhodesian time. So we didn't feel... what Mugabe or went through what Mugabe and his people went. So when things starting going wrong, we voted for change. It's a democratic country, so we voted for change. But Mugabe said, no, you guys, you didn't fight for this country, so you have to listen to us. So how can we just go along with everything he says? So we resisted.
Yeah.
The MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, Morgan Tsvangirai.
Yeah.
He won the election, but the man doesn't want to go.
And that's a little, it must be quite strange in a way, because when you look at Mugabe's history, he was liberated the country, helped liberate it from white minority rule.
Yes.
He spent time as a political prisoner.
Yeah.
So in a way, is this like, say, Mandela just said, well, I'm not going to give up ruling South Africa, I'm just going to go on forever and ever?
Yeah, but he says my time is up. He suffered more than Mugabe, 27 years.
Yeah.
He came out, it even disturbed his marriage.
Did he
go out with all guns blazing? No, he said, no, my time, I've saved my time. It's time to give, you know, others chance. But Mugabe, because he thinks Zimbabwe is his prize for, you know, for fighting Ian Smith during the Rhodesian time.
Okay.
And if you ask anybody in Zimbabwe right now, they will tell you that Ian Smith was better. Because during the Rhodesian time, for my understanding, everyone was eating. Everyone was having some sort of education. Of course, to a certain level, because, you know, if you were black, you were limited your education. But no one was starving. There was good medication in Zimbabwe right now. People are dying of cholera, which is a treatable thing. So you tell me, can I just go along with Mugabe? Because he did good thing, but can I just go along with Mugabe? People are dying in their thousands.
What do you make of the power-sharing arrangement that's been going on for the past 2 years? Do you think that's going to work out? I mean, Tsvangirai has his hands on some power now. And
it's a good thing, because Tsvangirai, we have advised him, they are genius, because people were dying. So he said, look, you got to join this guy. You can't kick him. We tried to push him. He doesn't want to go. So it's a way of... you know, compromising with Mugabe, if you like, and then we'll see the next general election, because he doesn't want to be humiliated by being defeated on the ballot box and they push him. Of course, he did some other things which we have to, you know, to acknowledge, but Tsvangirai, I think he did good thing, because people were really suffering. So.
And seeing as a lot of people are obviously probably not going to go to Zimbabwe as a tourist destination, and probably only associate negative things. Tell me, I don't know, what's the most positive thing that you left Zimbabwe that you could say, you know, what is it about Zimbabwe that was great, could be great?
Yeah, you have to come and see Victoria Falls. Yeah. It's one of the seven wonders of the world. But if you don't want to go to Zimbabwe directly, you go to South Africa,
yeah.
Go for a day trip to Victoria Falls. It's much safer that way.
Okay.
Everything at the moment it seems normal if you go to Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
But they'll be following you as long as you are British, American, or European. Yeah.
You'll have someone following you.
Yes. As long as you are not involving yourself in politics, you'll be okay. It seems all normal.
Okay.
But it's not.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Chanda. And we're going to play another track now called Tsiga.
Yeah.
And what is that about?
Tsiga is warning young girls and boys that you are growing up. It's a big, wide world out there.
Yeah.
Choose one boyfriend. There is all sort of complications, illness, disease, you name it. So behave yourself. That's what Tsiga means.
Tsiga. This is Tsiga by Chimanimani.
Thank you.
Conspiracy theories. Love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying that truth can be stranger than fiction when you take the time to dig out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many riddles, modern and not so modern. This week, a chapter entitled, Nothing to See Here.
Secrets and Lies, revealed by David Southwell. In our digital and interconnected age, it is easy to be fooled into thinking every secret can be found somewhere on the internet. It is also easy to imagine that satellite surveillance means there is no longer anywhere capable of being hidden from view. These widely held beliefs make the idea that governments and others still tell lies about a raft of locations seem ridiculous and even quaint. However, beneath our feet and under our noses are a host of secret buildings deeply connected to those in power. We are often told downright lies about the real nature of places that sometimes drop off official maps. Now is the chance to learn the secret locations and true purpose of some of these sensitive places. The right to privacy is not a right to secrecy, or an excuse to tell lies about issues of genuine public interest, even for our governments. The age of denying where government laboratories and military complexes are actually based did not end with the Cold War paranoia, and neither the public nor foreign nations are to be trusted with real facts of what occurs within their walls. Many other groups have good reasons for not revealing where certain places are located, and what happens at those places. After all, if they did not make a supreme effort at secrecy and obfuscation of the truth, they might have curious authors sneaking into their underground courtrooms, or gate-crashing their secret shindigs. If any part of London is the beating heart of London's West End, it is Piccadilly Circus, an intersection of some of the most famous streets in the world. With its neon apocalypse of advertising signs and the famous statue of Eros, whose real name is the Angel of Christian Charity, it has become a tourist attraction in its own right. Thousands of people pass over Piccadilly Circus every day, and yet none are aware that beneath their feet lies a secret Masonic temple, also used as London's Freemason Court, where Masonic judges and lawyers put on trial their brothers in the craft who have broken Masonic law. Outside of Freemasonry, few people know of its existence, though it was used as a location in Alan Moore's influential novel From Hell. Its status as a real place has been questioned. It should not be. It exists and is part of a larger collection of Masonic temples in the Piccadilly Circus area. In the late Victorian period, a series of above-ground and underground temples was constructed to cater for Freemasons whose other gentlemen's clubs were located in the West End and Westminster. Although not in use today, there is still a Masonic temple on the top floor of the famous Lilywhite store. Though similar temples at the top of Regent Palace Hotel, the Trocadero, and 7-11 Coventry Street, now an HMV record shop, are no longer in use. A similar number of temples was constructed underground. At least two remain in full operation, including the one in the basement of the Café Royal, which is entered through a secret door in a cloakroom. The courtroom could be entered through the old Criterion restaurant, and through another location, which cannot be revealed for legal reasons, as this was the route used to investigate it. The Freemason Court also functioned as the Masonic temple connected to the lodge that drew its members from the Hardwick Society, a debating club for London's lawyers, judges and barristers, which provided the judges for the court. From War Games to Stargate, whenever you see a road disappearing into a secret mountain base in a Hollywood movie, it's based on military facilities at Cheyenne Mountain, situated near Colorado Springs in the Rockies. Built in the 1950s in anticipation of the growing Soviet nuclear capability, the road passes through the iconic visual entrance and makes for a strange journey. Once past the 25-ton blast doors, the two-lane highway, complete with traffic lights, continues for more than a mile into the rock. The base was built using £1.5 million of dynamite at a modern-day cost of $18 billion. Given its exposure in movies, it is not exactly confidential that Cheyenne Mountain is the HQ of the North American Air Defense Command, NORAD, the arm of the US military responsible for watching the skies for enemy aircraft and missiles. However, the really hush-hush operations undertaken by the 1,300 people living and working in the subterranean city, mounted on thousands of steel springs to help it withstand a nuclear blast better, revolve around US Space Command, which is also based there. Formed in 1985, the space capabilities of the US Army, Navy, Air Force and Marines are brought together under the central control of Space Command. Linked to the nearby Space Warfare Center at Schriever Air Force Base, its official duties are monitoring the 8,200 man-made objects in orbit and maintaining military satellite capability. Space Command does much more than that, though. Unofficial duties of Space Command include the training and maintenance of America's Space Marines, an elite force trained to fight in zero gravity and whose existence is denied. The tracking of unidentified UFOs entering the Earth's atmosphere, but not thought to be a missile. and the monitoring and maintenance of all space surveillance and weapons systems, including all of the Black Project funded ones that are not meant to exist. Cheyenne Mountain is also home to the Space Battle Lab facility that undertakes pioneering work on space-based weapons, including the development of firearms for use in zero-gravity and pressurized craft. It is hard to imagine that the Pope reads anything other than the Holy Bible, but if he did wish for some more exotic bedtime reading, the Vatican's secret archives could provide him with more satanic, occult, pornographic and heretical works than any other library in the world. While elements of the Vatican Library have been open to the public since the 15th century, the cardinal in charge of the endeavour ensures that all the juicy stuff is kept hidden. The Catholic Church started the library at the beginning of the 4th century, recording not only its own details, but also those of heretical Christians and Gnostic sects. Although it officially claims that everything before the 9th century was lost, for reasons not entirely known, the majority of the material still exists, but access is strictly controlled. The Papal Inquisition brought many new titles into the clandestine collection, but it was the creation of Index Librorum Prohibitorum, Index of Forbidden Books, that gave the biggest boost to the Vatican Library's secret section. Under the index, copies of any heretical, satanic, occult or pornographic works discovered were immediately lodged with the Pope's librarians. Even legitimate Catholic scholars find access to many of the classified books difficult. One Jesuit working in the Vatican explained, "Control is achieved through not indexing material because you cannot request what you do not know exists." On another side of the library are the archives of papal and church papers. It takes real confidence in your power to keep buried what you do not want others to know, to call your repository of suppressed papers and documents something as blatant as the Vatican secret archives. Headed up by a cardinal in the same way that the Vatican Library is, the secret archives are home to everything the Church once kept in the dark, including Nazi collaboration and scandals dating back to the earliest periods in its history. Vast, purposely disorganised and running to more than 24 miles of shelves, the archives are only open to those with direct approval from the Pope.
That was read there by Malcolm Grieve, our very own actor and book reader, straight out of Swindon. Thank you to him, and we'll hear more from him next week. That was the book written by David Southwell called Secrets and Lies. Thank you very much there to David Southwell, the People's Undercover Agent, for letting us broadcast this on air. Well, let's hear what's going on in and around Bristol this week with Jeff Sparks. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 8th of July, Anvil will be performing with support from Girls' School at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £11.50 in advance. On to Friday, 9th of July, the Purple Hearts will be performing with support from The Solvents and also DJ Power Pop Bruce at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 9th of July, the Bon Jovi Experience will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £9 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present the Dreadnoughts. This group hail from Vancouver in Canada and are currently recording their third album. This is from their second album, Victory Square, and it's a track titled Samovar.
You are rolling softly in the night until you reach the morning light. Oh. plastic white. You were always softly in the night until you reach the morning light. The samovar is ready, boys. The samovar is here. The samovar is ready, boys. We shall persevere.
That was the Dreadnoughts with the track Samovar from the album Victory Square. For more information, you can check out www.thedreadnoughts.com. Moving into Saturday, 10th of July, Toots and the Maytals will be performing with support from Jazz Reggae Sessions, plus Yes Sir Boss and also Mr. Ben at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m, tickets are £20 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 11th of July, Green 61 will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every week when Dialect is online, or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find a low-bandwidth mono version of Dialect at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can always listen to BCFM on the internet at that website, bcfm.org.uk. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Chanda. Remember to check out the Chimanimani website, which is myspace.com/Chimanimani, obviously, which is spelled C-H-I-M-A-N-I-M-A-N-I, Chimanimani. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and the studio production was by Johnny Royden. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks, as ever, for his What's On, and Malcolm Grieve for reading another excellent episode of Secrets and Lies, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, so anyone can contribute. So if you're listening to it and you just want to come along and check out what we do, or with a specific idea for a feature or anything, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Well, that was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. Take care.